Just 10 days left in 2020, and you may be celebrating. Seems like many are happy to say goodbye to the year. But while those days remain, we want to use them to review this kind of one-of-a-kind year we've had across a number of subjects: medicine, music, sports. Last week, we talked movies. Today, it's social media. And we invite you to join the conversation. What characterized social media for you this year? How do you think history is going to judge the role of social media in 2020? What do you want or expect from social media platforms in 2021, whether that's in content, regulation? Join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got a couple great guests to chat with us on this. We have Joan Donovan, Research Director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, and Kimberly Atkins, Senior Opinion Writer at the Boston Globe and former colleague. Joan, Kimberly, welcome back to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have both of you. So in preparing for this conversation, producer Walter Wuthman and I talked a lot about what we kind of thought maybe the headline from the year in social media might be. And later I will tell you, but I want to start by asking that of each of you first. Joan, what's the social media headline for 2020?
Oh my goodness. It's quite a question. I was going back and looking all the way back to January where we started and where we are. And I think, yeah, we've got system failure, you know, so that would be my broad headline. That would be my one shot.
What about you, Kimberly?
I think it's the fight over accountability. You know, there was a lot of, it was no question that what was happening in a lot of ways was not good and was not working, but very few answers about exactly who is accountable for it and what can be done to fix it.
So listeners, what about you? What is the headline for social media in 2020? 1-800-423-8255 to join that conversation. All right, so I'll tell you, Walt and I were thinking that it had to do with the social media headline this year being the year that conspiracy went mainstream. Is this the year that conspiracy went mainstream, Joan?
I think I would agree with you. There's a question that I've been trying to explore in the research around, is this actually a feature of social media systems in general, that they move the fringe closer to the mainstream and therefore distort reality, especially as a lot of journalism begins with almost as if Twitter trending topics is their assigning editor. If you can make something trend, you can make it true in some instances.
Kimberly, you know, we've talked to you over the years from DC covering the court, covering public policy, covering the legislature. Are you seeing conspiracy theories entering the policy discussion in a way that surprises or alarms you this year coming out of social media?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the way, look, conspiracy theories, of course, are not in any way new. But what used to happen in the past is once myths and conspiracy theories were debunked, they would just stop getting attention in mainstream media organizations, whether it's newspapers or television. You just wouldn't hear much about them, and that would help them get shut down. A great example of that was the anti-vaccine movements of in the 90s and early 2000s had kind of started to pick up speed, but then once, you know, journals and medical journals started shooting it down, the media stopped paying attention to it. Well, they found a home on social media because you don't have that sort of gatekeeper that's going to stop them. And that led to the rise of that movement. The very same thing with some of these political conspiracy theories, which frankly just sound preposterous. But when given enough space on social media and when connected, when you have people who believe in them connecting to one another worldwide on social media, you certainly get a groundswell. And of course, you had the help this year with the person with the biggest platform, arguably, of them all, the President of the United States, retweeting or pushing some of these conspiracy theories. And that just helped them to catch fire.
You know, in listening to the two of you, putting that whole picture together, especially that last part you just said, Kimberly. So now we have a tweeter in chief who is constantly active on a platform that is widely criticized, Twitter, for not doing a good enough job to mitigate false content. announces real policy, real announcements from the White House that have important daily implications, including firings, resignations, you know, executive orders, et cetera, but then also traffics in conspiracy. Joan, does that make it impossible for us not to equate false content and conspiracy theories with real policy and real content when they're juxtaposed and driven by that powerful one person?
Undoubtedly. And as I think about this issue, what I've been drawn to is to try to understand the scale. And when we first really started dealing with misinformation post the 2016 election, it was a lot of, trying to understand the information ecosystem, trying to look at the role of automation and in making it look like there was a groundswell of attention to specific issues. We started to tilt our moderation policies on different platforms towards getting rid of bots and automated content. But as that was happening, the way in which misinformation was traveling through and across other platforms started to change. And as it changed, we became less concerned with anonymously run fake news sites and more concerned with what we call white propaganda, that is propaganda where we know its source. And the way in which Trump had utilized his Twitter account in particular was like a circumvention strategy. That is, he was constantly undermining the press who were trying to fact check everything that he said. And then in the same breath, you'd also have to, as a journalist, come back with, oh yeah, and what he said about the development of a vaccine is true, right? And so it does cause massive confusion for the public when the press is called in to deal with someone who is really utilizing and exploiting the openness of social media platforms to do disinformation at scale.
So then let's talk about the platforms themselves. And listeners, 1-800-423-8255, how are you feeling about the accountability level of the platforms themselves? Facebook, Twitter, Parler, TikTok. Is this a time for regulation, or are these places where information should roam free depending on how people want to curate it for themselves and what they want to say? Where do you think the lines ought to be drawn? 800-423-8255 again is that number. Kimberly, this was also a year where it seemed like the zeitgeist, that might not be the right word, but I'm sticking with it, around our attitude towards social media platforms went from cheerleader and, you know, in the case of Facebook at one point, hero worshiping, right, to feeling and being more critical of the role that they're playing in our society. How did you see that play out?
Oh, I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, social media started out as a way to sort of democratize information. If you know, everybody had a voice and everybody could express themselves in a way that the gatekeepers of traditional media would not allow, and it was seen as this really useful and great tool. But again, as disinformation and fomenting of really awful things in our society really took hold of the medium, we saw a lot of the problems that turn up when you don't have a gatekeeper, when you don't have anybody saying this cannot be on the platform or this can. And so we've seen a turn up of pressure on the leaders of these social media companies to alter their behavior, to implement policies that would prevent this sort of thing, and a real resistance from those like Mark Zuckerberg, the head of Facebook, who are saying that is not their job, that they are a platform, they are not a traditional medium, they are not a utility, they are just a platform for other people to express themselves, and to put that burden on them would essentially kill the effectiveness of those medium. There's also money being driven by this, right? You have Facebook that is acquiring other big social media companies. It bought Instagram, it bought WhatsApp, and now there is an antitrust action by the federal government and state attorneys general saying that it got too big in that way, and it's exerting its power in an anti-competitive way. It's just showing that there is really no legal or social mechanism in place to really hold these companies accountable. These aren't, it's not like Ma Bell in the 1980s yeah. that was broken up into the Baby Bells. It's an entirely different thing. And you have folks here in Washington that are trying to figure out, and in states, trying to figure out exactly what tools they can use to sort of hold it accountable when none of them really fit perfectly.
Let's grab a call here. We've got Steve on the line from Cambridge at the number 800-423-8255. Steve, go ahead.
Hey, my biggest gripe is the blue check verification. I mean, what are the standards for accreditation? And they themselves don't even follow it. So, you know, the blue check thing, either everyone gets on board, or like everyone gets in bed, or everyone sleeps on the floor, because they don't even follow their own standards. And you amplify these voices for people who don't, you know, they don't even follow the standards.
Thanks for that, Steve. So, Joan, I put Steve's mm-hmm. call with what we just heard from Kimberly. Are we at a time when there must be regulatory enforcement, even of just the basic standards that the platforms say they're going to stick to themselves, or at a higher level like Kimberly was talking about, you know, Washington looking at?
It's a great question. I think that there's no way that they can actually implement their terms of service because of the sheer scale of their networks. And they didn't really focus a lot on building curation tools. And to the question about, well, what does the blue check actually mean? When blue checks arrived, it's because anyone could sign up as anybody else. I could show up and be Donald Trump. This is actually why Donald Trump's name says real Donald Trump, because there were fake ones running around on the platform. And so blue check only means one thing, which is that the company has received verifying information that you are who you say you are. And they've limited that even because they can't do it for every user because it would overrun their systems. They do it for celebrities and newsworthy individuals who may be confused by other people in the public. And so the blue check doesn't really denote anything other than the company has verified that person's identity. But when it comes to standards, we do need to raise the standards in a similar way to how journalism professionalized, to say, well, we're going to have some rules about how we deal with sources. We're going to have some rules for how we deal with non-public individuals. And we're going to have a code of ethics that we hold each other to. And I think that as we understand what social media standards may be in the future, I think that there needs to be a broad public conversation about what things we are willing to allow and what things are going to be considered harmful to the public health and well-being of our society.
So, Joan, I think we have a caller who might push back on that a little. And just before I go to Dara, listeners, last question for you is, are you using social media now differently than you did a year ago or 2 years ago? And do you anticipate a year from now you'll be doing it even more differently? 800-423-8255. We've got Dara on the line from Waltham. Dara, go ahead.
Yeah, you are criticizing the platform, which are actually very democratic. They are for everybody. But actually, you don't listen. NPR in those categories, which is actually very non-democratic because it filters everything that it is against Republican Party, white men, President Trump. So which one is better?
Well, Dara, I take your criticism openly. I can tell you that we do not engage in those filters here on Radio Boston, but I do hear your point. And Joan and Kimberly, when you hear Dara right after Joan saying, well, we have to get to the point where we need to curate content, we need to have some rules and standards, there's Dara saying, you know, and maybe I'm paraphrasing or interpreting, I don't like the curation because it doesn't bring the viewpoints that I want forward, and social media is more democratic. Certainly around the election, we've heard that, Kimberly, and that's why we're seeing people move to Parler, which has basically said, hey, listen, no filters. It's your job to curate your own content and do your own fact-checking. We are where you come for truly what they would say is free speech. So what about that?
Yes, listen, they, as I said in the beginning, that's what social media was seen as a very democratizing force in a world where traditional media is not as open. And that was one of the benefits of it. And that still is seen as one of the benefits of it. But you also have this idea that particularly this year, that anything that is turns a critical eye, anything that is truth-speaking against the president of the United States in particular, is left-leaning. So just telling a true fact can be seen as a leftward bias, which isn't always true. Certainly, some media organizations do have biases. But to call social media that, when you open it up and then turn it around and say, well, no, it's biased against certain individuals. We need to go find our own space that doesn't have that bias. It doesn't always ring completely true, but it's certainly the idea behind Parler and these other forms of media that are more likely to appeal to folks on the right. It just shows how divisions within a society can perpetuate themselves in whatever medium is available, including social media.
Joan, a few years ago when I was teaching social work, we were just beginning to explore whether Facebook was a place that made people more lonely or more depressed based on research that was coming out, or gave people a chance to find their people when they might not in their particular geographic community, let's say. Where today does the research land on whether, on balance, social media platforms are healthy for communities and people or not?
So I've been taking a deep dive into medical misinformation since the beginning of the pandemic. And the way in which people are being targeted by medical misinformation, grifts, scams, hoaxes, is not by virtue of the fact that popular information rises to the top. There's people out there with specific budgets and strategies for reaching into networks of people who are seeking information, vulnerable people who are, for instance, seeking information about the pandemic and are looking to buy masks, for instance. We remember that that rush. Those moments are what make people very, very vulnerable to misinformation, especially as Facebook has decided in some instances that they were going to allow targeted advertising and then they weren't going to allow it. And so we've seen these companies really waffle when journalists go out and find the evidence to say these are causing widespread public harms. We have all kinds of rules.
Joan, we're going to run out of time, so I'm not cutting you off, but I need you to wrap that up.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying that essentially that we do know that some aspects of these platforms do contribute to harm in a big way.
All right. Thank you. Sorry to cut it short there, Joan, but the show
does. It's all good.
We just were going to run out of time. Joan Donovan, Research Director of the Shorenstein Center, and Kimberly Atkins, Senior Opinion Writer at the Boston Globe. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll do more Year in Review this week, listeners. Thanks for listening and engaging today. That's our show. I'm Tiziana Deering. Tune in again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.